Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, the idea of global warming has been around for, I guess, about a quarter century or so now, since the mid-80s maybe, and most climatologists and meteorologists and other scientists who pay close attention to that kind of thing have come to accept that climate change is occurring, right, and that the Earth is warming up. But it's controversial still, and Al Gore's documentary a couple years back, An Inconvenient Truth, dramatized the whole issue for a mass market, or maybe actually over-dramatized it in the view of a lot of people. So there are plenty of well-regarded scientists who remain unconvinced, and I think the majority, the great majority of scientists who pay attention to climate do believe that the data show clearly that there are human impacts on climate and that we're on an upswing as far as climate change in the direction of global warming, right? So there's kind of a tug-of-war and a battle to some extent going on among those scientists. Meanwhile, the U.S. industry is largely resistant to the idea of global change, since the bottom line of it is that it brings more regulations and costs. So, you know, everybody in my listening audience is familiar with this thing. It's highly political. The U.S. government has vacillated on getting behind climate change in any serious way. And that's because it's very political in terms of industry and environmentalists and so on. Then there was a revelation in 2009 that scientists at a major climate research center in England were essentially cooking the books, withholding and suppressing data and covering up emails that ran contrary to the dogma that climate change is occurring. So that complicated the picture some more and gave ammunition to the people who basically are against the idea of climate change and global warming. So then 2010 tied 2005 as the warmest year on record, right? However, the harsh winters of 2009 and 10 and 2010 and 11 have again called into question the idea of global warming because they're very severe winters. So, you know, what's the poor average guy supposed to think? Somebody without an axe to grind? It's hard to tell exactly with confidence which side is right, right? So that's why we're having a show today, as you may have ascertained, on climate change. And my guest is Dr. David Easterling, who's the chief of the Global Climate Applications Division of NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, its National Climate Data Center, which is in Asheville. So the National Climatic Data Center is called NCDC, and that's in Asheville, North Carolina. So welcome, Dave. Can I call you Dave?
Yes, you can. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Well, first, why don't you tell us just briefly, what does the NCDC do?
The NCDC, National Climatic Data Center, is the world's largest archive of weather and climate data. We are a federal government archive, and we receive feeds of data from satellites and radars and weather stations all around the world, and we archive them. We produce products such as the normals. You know, whenever you hear the weather forecasters say the tomorrow's going to be above normal or below normal, those normals are calculated here at the NCDC. We also do research with the data, especially in the observed record, since we have all this data. We have data from these weather stations. We also have a group in Boulder, Colorado that does paleoclimate, which is reconstructing the climate using tree rings and ice cores and that sort of thing. And we look at the climate, we sort of document what's going on with the climate in terms of past history and try to place current events, especially into historical context. So we do a wide variety of stuff with the data that we actually have here.
Well, do you, in addition to collecting data and packaging it and processing it and preparing it in different ways, do you do research and produce opinions based on that, on the data in a scientific way?
We do. I personally do research in climate change, looking at climate change in the observed record, trying to document what has happened in the climate over about the past 100 to 150 years. I also participate in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is the large body that produces a report about every 5 to 6 years that sort of documents the state of the science, what we currently think we know about climate change, both in terms of the observed record and also what we think is going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm. You know, at the outset, I mentioned climate change and global warming kind of in the same sentence, but I think a lot of people are not clear on the distinction between those two, whether they're one and the same thing or what. So what is the difference or the distinction between those concepts of climate change and global warming?
Well, I mean, global warming, I think, is the more popular notion that we're increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases, and that's leading to a warming of global temperatures. And that's documented in a graph that we produce every year looking at sort of the globally average temperature. It's sort of a measure, much like taking somebody's temperature and determining whether they have a fever. We have this number that averages up to the global number and gives us sort of one number for the globe each year, and it indicates that, yes, we're seeing warming. Climate change really refers to in the broader context of, if you have a warming of the climate, you're also having changes in other parts of the climate, the hydrologic system. We're seeing changes in precipitation, drought, changes in the oceans, all these different things are really collectively climate change. So global warming really is just one part of it, but I think the public tends to latch on and probably identifies more the global warming rather than climate change.
Global warming is more the high visibility part of it, because it's where all of the political and environmental impacts that we hear most about come to bear.
Right.
So the argument is really whether this is a natural cycle that's been accelerated and made more extreme by human interventions and human impacts over the last, since the industrial age started, I guess, or whether it's just a natural cycle, period, that's going to go on regardless of whether humans were on Earth or not. Right? I mean, is that a pretty fair way to characterize it, that that's the argument between the two camps that I described at the beginning?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, the climate changes on all sorts of timescales. I mean, we've had ice ages, obviously, and we've had periods in the past when it's been a lot warmer than it is today. But, you know, the thing to keep in mind about the climate is that it's a system that responds to a forcing. It's not going to change. It's going to have variability from year to year. And this past year, for example, was unusually cold on the East Coast. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but the bottom line is you have to have something that causes the climate to change, sort of an external forcing factor. And the main ones are, you know, the sun, obviously. The output from the sun varies somewhat. Volcanoes, when they go off, they put a lot of sulfate particles, little particles of sulfur into the atmosphere, and that tends to block some of the incoming energy from the sun. It leads to cooling. So those are sort of natural forcings. But we also have human forcings, and these are increasing greenhouse gases and also the sulfate particles that come out of power plants and that sort of thing. And these also force the climate to change. On a much longer time scale, the reason why we have ice ages and interglacials and that sort of thing are the changing relationships between the Earth and the sun. But on a shorter time scale, and that's what we're really talking about here in terms of climate change and global warming, is that these changes that we're seeing now are sort of accelerated, and the changes are occurring fast enough that they would actually impact both human systems and natural systems to the point that they have a hard time adapting. And that's what the real issue is, that by putting these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we're sort of accelerating this warming. And the fact that natural systems, forests, and that sort of thing may or may not be able to adapt in the time frame that we're talking about, which is over the next, say, 50 to 100 years.
Is the injection of greenhouse gases the primary thing that humans do that affect climate change? How about deforestation, for example? I mean, are there other big factors that the human presence on Earth exerts on climate?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, you know, anybody that's flown over the United States and you look down and see how much the landscape is altered by humans, that is going to impact the climate. But the biggest thing that we're doing to impact the climate, obviously, is the increasing greenhouse gases by burning fossil fuels. Deforestation actually contributes to that as well. But so deforestation both changes the Earth's surface, and that's going to actually feed to the atmosphere and change the climate, but also the fact that you deforested an area, all that carbon that was locked up in those forests goes into the atmosphere. And so the biggest factor is the increasing greenhouse gases.
And the main greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, or?
Yeah, that's right. The main greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide. There are other greenhouse gases, actually water vapor. The water vapor in the atmosphere is probably the most powerful one, but, you know, there's a natural greenhouse effect that keeps temperatures on Earth warm enough to sustain life. Without this natural greenhouse effect, the average temperature of the Earth would be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit, but the average temperature of the Earth is about 58 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, warm enough to support life. And water vapor is a large part of that, but what happens is, as you warm the atmosphere up with this increase in greenhouse gases, you're increasing the water-holding capacity of the atmosphere. And so you get more water vapor in the atmosphere. It's sort of a second-order effect. You warm the atmosphere up because you put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That allows more evaporation and more water vapor to go in the atmosphere, which then warms it up even more. But, yeah, the biggest thing is that humans are doing is increasing the carbon dioxide, methane, which is another big greenhouse gas, mm-hmm. nitrous oxides, Even ozone near the ground is a greenhouse gas. These are all being increased due to the burning of fossil fuels mainly.
So as far as you're concerned, it sounds like the data are absolutely incontrovertible and totally slam dunk that human inputs into the environment are creating accelerated climate change, right?
Yeah, and that was actually a finding by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the fourth assessment report that I worked on that came out in 2007. I mean, it's pretty much unequivocal the climate has warmed over the since about 1900. And we say in scientific terms sort of this very likely. It says that we're 90% or greater sure that that warming is due to increasing greenhouse gases and other human factors.
Well, it does seem like there are some pretty serious and well-regarded scientists who have the opposite view, that human impacts are pretty minor in this cycle of climate change. So can I ask you, if you could, briefly to characterize their point of view? I mean, what do they base that that rejection of the idea on?
Well, actually, there are very, very few true climate scientists, those that are really working climate science, that feel that way. There are a few that say that the landscape changes are very important and they're not being emphasized as much as the increase in carbon dioxide, but most of the scientists that are that sort of take that opposing view are not climate scientists, and some, I guess, simply don't believe that some will say that the solar output is more powerful than it really is, the changes in the amount of energy coming in from the sun, which is a forcing, and it would cause some climate change, but a very small amount compared to the amount that increase in carbon dioxide. I mean, carbon dioxide, you know, the fact that carbon dioxide absorbs and sort of traps this heat energy in the earth, in the atmosphere and all is well established. I mean, it was established back in the, you know, 1850s and 40s that this sort of thing is the carbon dioxide actually absorbs energy and re-emits it. So, you know, that fact is pretty well established in the scientific literature. It's just, but sort of getting back to this whole notion that there's some significant number of climate scientists that do not believe that climate is changing due to human factors is very, very small. I mean, that's, you know, it's really, you know, probably less than 1 or 2% of the climate, true working climate scientists.
Okay. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. David Easterling, who is the director or chief of the Global Climate Applications Division at the National Climatic Data Center, the NCDC, in Asheville, North Carolina. So, Dave, what kind of tools and approaches do climatologists and other scientists use to study climate change?
Well, we use the observe record, which is basically where we are using temperature and rainfall and pressure and various measures of the climate from observing stations all around the world. And we use those measurements to document the past changes in the climate, you know, to say that, yes, the climate has warmed about a degree Fahrenheit since 1900, to look at changes in precipitation and changes in extreme events. That's one of the big ones is, you know, yes, we've documented that the mean climate is changing, but what about changes in extreme events? And we documented that, you know, we're seeing changes, increases in heavy precipitation events, for example, in many parts of the globe. So we use the observe record, but we also use climate models. These are very complex computer simulation programs that are run on supercomputers that simulate the climate. And really the only way that we can study what we think might happen to the climate over the next 50 to 100 years is to use these computer climate models and take a look at how these models show the climate changing as we change things like the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere.
You mentioned a while ago the amount of rainfall, and it does seem like the weather worldwide for the last several years has just gotten more extreme. I mean, not just in terms of snow and so on, but hurricanes seem stronger and more numerous, and, you know, big tornado outbreaks and massive floods. I mean, you know, devastating types of floods and blizzards and extremes of heat and cold. So are all those things put together an indicator of climate change, or is it just sort of better reporting in the internet and something, you know, I mean, is it natural, or does it seem to climatologists that the weather is more unsettled and more extreme than in past decades?
Well, when you really sit down and analyze, I think part of that actually has to do with the sort of the enhanced reporting effect that, you know, tornadoes, for example, they're observed by people actually seeing them. and also on the radars now. But, you know, in the past, if a tornado happened in Farmer Jones' field and he didn't see it, then it didn't happen. So there's a little bit of that element in there. We've had a number of what we call these sort of black swan events, such as these really extreme, such as the 2003 European heat wave and the Moscow heat wave, the Russian heat wave this past summer, that seemed to be a little bit out of what you would expect, and, you know, much more severe. So, it's sort of a combination. When we look at extremes and we're really trying to document that scientifically, we have documented changes, like I said, in heavy precipitation events and that sort of thing. And, but in terms of things like hurricanes, it's really tough to say that hurricanes have become more powerful. We expect them to become more powerful if you look at the modeling studies. When you increase the ocean temperatures, for example, you expect to see more powerful hurricanes, but it's hard to say. And the other part of that is that, you know, when you look at something like hurricanes, you're only looking at one basin in the world. And there are typhoons, which are essentially hurricanes in the West Pacific,
sure.
Cyclones in the Indian Ocean. And really, to say globally, are we seeing a change in the number of tropical cyclones like that is a really tough one, because that's one of the phenomena where the data really are not that good, and probably not good enough to detect a long-term trend, and at least globally, in terms of the number of tropical cyclones. So sort of the answer to your question is, yeah, it's sort of a combination. We think that we're seeing increases in the number of extreme events, but the media also sort of plays a part in the public perception there.
And maybe population density. There are more people living along coastlines and in, you know, places that are more vulnerable,
right,
too, but, and more people.
Yeah, I mean, there has been this sort of documented increase in damages from hurricanes. Well, a large part of that is simply due to the fact that there's a lot more property and people in harm's way now than there was, say, in the 1930s and 40s.
But still, how do you explain, you know, I mentioned at the outset the past two winters that were extremely cold and extremely snowy. I mean, just seemed like blizzard after blizzard, you know, nonstop pretty much. Is that, I think it's highly unusual. I mean, even going back a century. So do people explain that just as being a coincidence or a normal oscillation, or is it tied to climate change? Do people understand that and say that, or is it just basically unknown?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question, because typically what happens is, you know, you get an extremely cold winter, for example, on the East Coast, like we had this past winter and the winter before. And people go, well, you know, where's global warming now? But what it points out is you got to keep in mind that global warming means global, not just local. Hmm. And so there's going to be excursions such as unusually cold winters still, even with global warming. I mean, the main reason why we had an unusually cold and snowy winter this year and last year on the East Coast was because we ended up in what we call the negative phase of the North Atlantic Oscillation, which allowed a lot of very cold air from Canada to move down into the central and eastern part of the country. But what that did was it left Canada a lot warmer than normal. So if you look at maps of where it was unusually warm last winter, it was in the higher latitudes, especially in Canada and also sort of the higher latitudes north of Europe. Europe was unusually cold too. However, you know, that cold air basically moved from Canada down into the eastern part of the country. So it was unusually warm in Canada, unusually cold in the eastern part of the country. Next year, we might have the reverse. You know, we have a North Atlantic Oscillation, which is basically the difference in air pressure between the area over Iceland and the area over sort of the Azores just off the coast of Spain. And it allows this cold air to kind of move down. It may flip again next year, and we may end up being unusually warm again. I mean, if you look at sort of the predictions this past winter for sort of the seasonal prediction, because of the La Nina we had, we thought it was going to be actually a little bit warm and dry, but it ended up being cold, and you know, it was still pretty dry, even though we had snow. But that just shows that, yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to still end up with these unusually cold periods, winters every now and then, even in the face of climate change and global warming.
Yeah, I had been going to ask you about La Nina, because my understanding was that the La Nina accentuated the flow of moisture up from the Gulf in particular into the Southeast and the Midwest and the Northeast, and caused a lot of these back-to-back blizzards. But wasn't that the case then?
Well, I mean, that's not exactly true. The reason why we had sort of these back-to-back blizzards is you had these cold air outbreaks that made it all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. When they hit there, they kind of spun up a storm. And honestly, it was still actually unusually dry here in the southeast, at least parts of it, even though we had these snowstorms. You know, a snowstorm that gives you, let's say, 6 inches of rain, of snow, really is only giving you about 6 tenths of an inch of liquid water. So you could still be in the midst of a drought even if you got a lot of snow on the ground.
Yeah, I see. So it's the cold that was the big factor.
Right.
We're talking with Dr. David Easterling, who is a climate scientist at the National Climatic Data Center, Nashville, North Carolina, about climate change. So, Dave, what are some of the effects of climate change on the world, other than the kinds of things, you know, the effects on people that we've been talking about? But for example, on forests and on glaciers and on oceans and on air quality and that kind of thing, what are some of the effects of the trends that you see occurring?
Well, if we start with glaciers, if you look at a lot of the alpine glaciers, these are glaciers like in the Alps, or even in, let's say Glacier National Park here in the United States, they're retreating. They've been retreating. I've seen, one of the really nice juxtaposed, set of pictures that I have when I do talks is I show a picture of the Muir Glacier in southeastern Alaska in 1943 and then in 2003. And it's just amazing how much that glacier has retreated back up the valley. And the area where the glacier was in 1943 is now just a big lake. So we're seeing impacts there. Forests is a really interesting one because if you look out west right now, like in, let's say, British Columbia and all the way down into Colorado, the forests there are actually having a lot of problems with die-off due to pine beetles. And the reason why they're dying off due to pine beetles is because pine beetles require very extreme cold to sort of control their population. And temperatures typically need to get down below minus 30 degrees, down to almost minus 40 degrees to kill off most of them so you don't have these big population explosions. Well, temperatures out west have just simply not been getting that cold during the wintertime in the recent years. And so they've had an explosion of these pine beetles and actually infesting the pines and killing off millions of acres of pine trees.
Right.
It's actually a very big concern in British Columbia.
Sure.
And a lot of the logging and timber companies up there.
And even in California, I know that's happening. And it also causes then huge forest fires because vast tracts of trees just die and are standing there ready to burn.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, and it's exacerbated by the drought in the West, too, because what happens is these trees get weakened. And if the pine beetles don't kill them off, they're weakened, and then the drought may end up killing them off. So it's a big issue with the forest, especially in the West.
What about warming? I mean, we read in Florida about the coral reefs, and I imagine it's the same around the world, the coral reefs being affected by, on the one hand, cold snaps, and then on the other hand, much warmer seas. So what about the health of oceans? Is it greatly affected in a negative way by climate change?
The corals is a really good example of that because corals, whatever the species of corals is, tends to live in a fairly narrow temperature zone. And so when you have excursions, such as either unusually cold or unusually warm, and what's really happened lately is the unusually warm temperatures, you get what's called coral bleaching, where the corals they expel the sort of symbiotic algae that's in them because they're stressed. And so it ends up a lot of the color is due to these algae. And what happens is they expel the algae, and so they become bleached. And it's actually ends up dying off to a large extent. So if temperatures warm up too much, then a lot of these corals end up bleaching and reefs end up having a lot of problems like that.
Yeah, getting sick. I've read, too, that north of the Arctic Circle, tundra, you know, in Alaska and, you know, all around the whole world north of the Arctic Circle that's been frozen for thousands of years is now starting to thaw out, and that's causing problems because it's releasing methane and other gases that have been trapped there forever. And I guess the vegetation that's there is beginning to rot or what? I mean, so is that a function of climate change and global warming as well?
Yeah, and if you go to Alaska, that's really good.
Segue
into the issue up there because, you know, you have all this permafrost, especially at the margins of the permafrost. That's where the big issues are, is where, you know, you have things, if you go a little bit north and you hit the permafrost, well, what's happening is, you know, it's been unusually warm up there. And so, you're getting a lot of this permafrost melting back. And when it does melt back, it's, you know, they have a lot of carbon dioxide, especially methane, locked up in them. And so that actually causes what we call sort of a feedback effect. You melt back some of this this permafrost, and it releases methane, which then would actually lead to a little bit more warming, and then it leads to more melting back and that sort of thing. So it's a big issue up there because you're releasing not only the methane, but, you know, there's a lot of their infrastructure is sort of dependent on the fact that you have permafrost, you know, roads and that sort of thing. And when you start melting permafrost back, then you're causing roads to buckle and a lot of those sorts of problems.
So it sounds like, you know, both in the case of the permafrost in the tundra and in the forest, that some of the effects you get themselves then tend to accelerate the effects, right? So it's kind of a snowballing thing.
Right. And that's why we're seeing the greatest warming in the highest latitudes. It's due to what we call the snow sort of ice reflectivity feedback. What happens is snow and ice are really good reflectors of incoming energy from the sun. So about 90% of it, when it strikes the snow surface, is reflected back out to space. But if you melt that back and you have either open ocean or ground, then you're actually absorbing a lot more of that energy that might have been reflected back out in space due to the snow, and sort of it feeds back. So you get more warming, you're melting more snow back, and so forth.
Well, Dave, we just have a minute or so left, but can human interventions do anything to really to reverse this huge process that's going on all around the world, or even slow it? I mean, how confident are we that changes in industry and industrial gases output will have much of an effect on this humongous process that's going on around the world?
Well, I mean, we can certainly try to do our part. I mean, by trying to reduce carbon emissions wherever we can, whether it's, you know, walking more or that sort of thing. But, you know, honestly, I'll be quite honest. I don't necessarily see us changing from a mainly carbon-based economy to one that's more based on renewables and that sort of thing in the next, say, 10 to 15 years. That's a question I get a lot, and I just simply don't see it happening. I just don't see the economy and politicians and people like that having the stomach for that. So I think the watchword really is going to be more adaptation than mitigation, people learning to adapt to the changes they see.
Yeah, and I hate to be pessimistic, but the population will continue to grow. The world's population will continue to grow, and then I think there'll be more and more urbanization in the emerging economies because that's where the jobs are and the wealth is, and people will move from little subsistence-based villages out to the cities, right? So as that accelerates, it'll just increase this problem. So I think, you know, at best, the changes we can bring to bear in industry will just kind of slow the process. Is that a fair statement, you think?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I mean, you know, and to be honest with you, there are good reasons beyond just the climate change to move away from fossil fuels. I mean, that's a finite resource. Sooner or later, they're going to run out. And so I think starting now to develop alternatives is a really good idea.
Well, Dave Easterling, I appreciate you being on with us on American Variety. Obviously, it's a very big topic, and we could talk about it for hours, but I think we've covered sort of the basics and hopefully have filled in a little gaps in knowledge in some of our listeners, including myself. And so those who'd like to learn a little bit more can go to www.ncdc.noaa, that's NOAA.gov. And that's the National Climatic Data Center's website, ncdc.noaa.gov. And there's a lot of video there and articles, and you can really get much more in-depth on this subject. I want to thank you for being on.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.